On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Son of the Dominican Republic and New Jersey, Juno Diaz made a huge splash a decade ago with a tough, vivid collection of short stories on Latino ghetto life called Drown. Now, Diaz is back with a debut novel that is knocking the socks off critics. The brief, wondrous life of Oscar Wao tracks one heart-torn family from surreally brutal dictatorship in Santo Domingo to a sexy, urban, sci-fi, Spanglish tragic comedy in the USA. Time magazine calls it astoundingly great. Up next, On Point, Juno Diaz and Oscar Wao. Joining me now in the studio is Juno Diaz. He was born in the Dominican Republic and grew up in New Jersey. For the past decade, he's been publishing short stories in publications like The New Yorker and The Paris Review. Now he's out with his debut novel, The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. The New York Times critic, Michiko Kakutani, raves it's where Mario Vargas Llosa meets Star Trek, meets David Foster Wallace, meets Kanye West. That is a place we want to be. Juno Diaz, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, they're throwing garlands all over you here. You finally got it out and the place goes wild.
You're like, wow, okay, now for the next one.
Yeah, right. The publisher's foot is already tapping.
Oh, it's my foot. Okay. I'm harder than they are.
Oh, geez, that's the way it goes. You start this book right out with a concept that some people will know very well, too well, and some not at all, fuku.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, one of the things I always notice is how much in, like, literature there's curses, like as in, like, you know, curses against family, like the Greeks.
I curse you and all your generations
exactly.
Unto
the... Yeah, they're great in the Bible. Right. The Greeks love them, the House of Atreus, the House of Agamemnon. And so the fuku is the local curse in the Dominican Republic, which is just considered generally bad luck.
Yeah, and that is a very, very, very mild way of describing it as you describe it in here. I mean, this is... it's bad luck, but it's also kind of a deep, gnarly, rooted sense of finger of doom that in some way you trace back to the kind of origins of the New World, the Caribbean and its meeting with Europe. Describe that for us.
Yeah, well, one of the things about it is that, you know, at the most generic form, the fuku is just bad luck. If you're like, you can't have kids, somebody will be like, oh, you have a fuku on you, your ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
No, like your ex-girlfriend put a curse on you.
Oh, okay.
You know, mm-hmm. Or if you're always crashing your car, they'll be like, ah, it's because he cheated his mechanic and his mechanic put a curse on him. Mm-hmm. But there's also the deeper, deeper meaning where some people think that the fuku, this whole idea of this curse and of bad luck that follows people, started with the arrival of Columbus. And that in Santo Domingo, some people, if you even say his name aloud, that's considered why you've had all your bad luck.
Yes, and it's a word they use in response, and I'm Zafa.
Yeah, Zafa, exactly.
You must say Zafa to cleanse the air of the curse of the fuku that's just been mentioned.
Yeah. So you mentioned Columbus's name. If somebody doesn't say Zafa, everybody in the room's in a lot of trouble.
Cross your index fingers, scare away the demon. You describe it as, in a way, the curse and doom of the New World. You know, Christopher Columbus is celebrated in this country very widely, not in all corners, but you describe this deep ambivalence. What's that about?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, Santo Domingo, the first island, the first country, the first space, the place of the New World, and in some ways the United States is the last. You know, it's the final culmination of everything that's happened in the New World. Mm. It's the inheritor of what began in Santo Domingo. And so, of course, that ambivalence back in the DR is kind of a weird one because, you know, this is the place where everything started, but people look around and they're like, damn, man, things didn't work out too well for us.
What about this? You're talking about the belief that the arrival of Europeans on Hispaniola, the great island that the Dominican Republic shares with Haiti, unleashed the fuku on the world, and you write that it's not just an ancient history. It is and has been very much alive and with us in its sort of deepest, most disturbing sense. In the Dominican Republic, particularly unto the dictatorship of Trujillo.
Yeah, no, I mean, part of this is just the way people try to deal with history. I mean, there's so much history that nobody wants to speak about, and just speaking about what happened in the Caribbean with the arrival of Europeans, there's like a huge silence around it. So I think it's easier to talk about a curse than to talk about the exact history. And then Trujillo was considered by many this dictator in the Dominican Republic who ran from 1930 to 1961. In some ways, he was considered the apotheosis, the kahuna of this curse. Like, if the bad luck could be concretized into one person, it was him.
And a bad, bad guy. If Christopher Columbus is sort of, who you never name, he's sort of he who must not be named in this book, the admiral, you call him. Trujillo is, as you say, the kind of culmination of all this badness, and it comes down very heavily on the people of the Dominican Republic and the family you describe here. You know, I think it'd be worth it if you'd be kind enough for a two-second history lesson here. I don't think many Americans know just how the United States was involved with the Dominican Republic, which figures so hugely in Oscar Wao. I mean, occupied a colony, in effect, for a long time, backing this Trujillo. Lots of fibers between the U.S. and the Fuku of this dictator.
Yeah. No, I mean, but, you know, that's something that I think both Americans and Dominicans share in common, which would be very little knowledge about the history of the whole, what's been going on or what's happened. I mean, the United States invaded and occupied the Dominican Republic in 1916, had a military occupation for a long time. Famous during the occupation because this was during Prohibition. And so American soldiers desperately wanted to serve in Santo Domingo.
Post me there.
Yeah, they were like
the
drinking and the dancing. Right. And it was a very popular place to serve from all the Marine records. And then there was a U.S. invasion in 1965 as a kind of a runner-up. LBJ's testing the water in some ways for what was going to happen in Vietnam later the year. That
the escalation, year. Anti-communist.
Yep.
So lots of interaction here. I wish you'd read a little bit from early on in the book where you sort of clue us into just how tied up these countries are and Fuku hanging over the whole relationship.
Yeah, no, this is where the book begins and the narrator is talking about sort of the curse of the Fuku and how it has, like, fingers almost everywhere. And it says, the character goes, you want a final conclusive answer to the Warren Commission question, who killed John F. Kennedy? Kennedy, let me, your humble watcher, reveal once and for all God's honest truth. It wasn't the mob or LBJ or the ghost of Marilyn Monroe. It wasn't aliens or KGB or the lone gunman. It wasn't the Hunts brothers of Texas or Lee Harvey or the Trilateral Commission. It was Trujillo. It was the Fuku. Where in Coñazo do you think the curse of the Kennedys come from? How about Vietnam? Why do you think the greatest power in the world lost its first war to a third world country like Vietnam? I mean, Negro, please. It might interest you that just as the U.S. was ramping up its involvement in Vietnam, Lyndon B. Johnson launched an illegal invasion of the Dominican Republic. Santo Domingo was Iraq before Iraq was Iraq. A smashing military success for the U.S. and many of the same units and intelligence teams that took part in the democratization of Santo Domingo were immediately shipped off to Saigon. What do you think these soldiers, technicians, and spooks carried with them in their rucks, in their suitcases, in their shirt pockets, on the hair inside their nostrils, caked up around their shoes? Just a little gift from my people to America, a small repayment for an unjust war. That's right, folks. Fuku.
Fuku, the curse. Even going back there in that reading to the trials of JFK. Into that setting, you plunge us into the middle of the life of a family kind of built here around, well, a very tough mother and a daughter and a son, but the one you call Oscar Wao. Introduce Oscar Wao to us.
Yeah, Oscar is kind of the protagonist of the book. He's like the quote-unquote hero. And when I was coming up with this book, I had this really stark image of this very fat Dominican sweet kid who is just into all the probably the worst things you could be into: Star Trek, science fiction, comic books, for what he desires most. And what he desires most is a girlfriend.
Yeah, love.
He just wants a girl to fall in love with him, but he can never seem to put away his nerdiness enough to be able to talk to any girl in a way that makes sense.
In spite of the fact that he's got the model, Lola, his sister, who's hot and hot as a pistol and all around him and wants to tell him just what to do.
Well, you know how it is, man, especially when you're a boy, when you're young, maybe even when you're a girl. It's, yeah. Whenever people try to help you, it's so hard to hear.
And a mother, very much shaped, traumatized by the family history that really touches everybody here right out of the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, the mom carries the history on her back. She has this kind of tremendous scar across her whole back and about both her interactions and falling in love during the dictatorship and how that got her into tremendous trouble.
You bring history into the middle of all kinds of pop culture and comic books and science fiction and the Latino life so vividly here. I mean, are you telling us that this is a rucksack on the back of, Latinos these days that we don't see, that we need to look at more closely?
I just think in general, I mean, you can't live in the Americas, whether you're up in Canada, whether you're down in Santo Domingo, where you're in Argentina, without sort of the shadow of history on you. And I think one of the things about when I grew up in this generation, both in Santo Domingo and the United States, nobody ever told me to pay attention to history. The now was the most important. I mean, for me, my history was pop culture. I learned more about the fake history of Star Trek and Star Wars than I did about what was going on in the past United States.
Let's take a call from Michael, calling from Ashford, Connecticut. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. That concept of a curse of history resting upon the modern world made me think of William Faulkner's work and how he saw, running through all the evil that transpires in his novels, as the existence of slavery or the importation of Africans into the southern New World. And I just wonder if you've explored that at all or not, and I have to confess I haven't read any of your books, although I intend to get the latest one.
It's pretty terrific. Junior Diaz, how about Faulkner and his sense of the curse running through life? And he, you know, drawing it back to something near your story, to slavery.
Yeah, no, I mean, your caller is crazy perceptive because I'm obsessed with Faulkner. That sense of doom across many Southern writers, but he was in some ways he was the greatest of them all. And I myself was reading so much Faulkner when I was thinking about this because he did such a wonderful job of how you paint that shadow on people while still making them people, you know, not having them overwhelmed by the history, but never letting your reader forget them. So, yeah, no, believe me, that was a huge guide. I mean, I did as much as I could to steal from him.
You start the book right out saying, "They say it came first from Africa, carried in the screams of the enslaved, that it was the death bane of the Tainos, uttered just as one world perished and another began, that it was a demon drawn into creation through the nightmare door that was cracked open in the Antilles, Fuku Americanus, or more colloquially, Fuku." That meeting of old world and new world sort of birthing a curse, right? At that crack, the door cracked open in the Antilles, your island neighborhood. What is it about, I don't know, the great human mural that requires a curse be born in through that door?
I just think it's so hard for like one mind to sort of grasp, for us as individuals, even for us as a family, to understand how history works. How does the weight of national history, the weight of two worlds meeting, how does that interact with the fact that I like to get up in the morning and go for a run, that I watch really bad reality shows, you know, that I'm like, you know, a morning person and that I'm like a Mets fan and a Red Sox fan? You know, what in the world does that have anything to do with it?
You're skipping along through the kind of surface of life, and behind you is this great, massive fact.
Well, it's just hard to just link, to interface with. And I think the ideas of curses have been a way that storytellers from the beginning have allowed history a place, even though it's kind of a metaphoric history, in our daily stories. You know, if I were to tell you, oh, you know, the fact that your great-great-grandfather had a canning factory and that burnt down and that, is the reason you're this way, you're like, are you insane? How can you be that reductive?
And yet?
And yet, if I say to you, oh, yeah, well, you know, he had a bunch of folks working in his factory and they cursed your family, suddenly becomes a real story.
You have my full attention.
Yeah, it becomes a real story. And it's just a cheap trick. I mean, I hate to sound so corny, but it's a cheap trick to get history on the page.
Hey, the writer tells all. Are you saying, I mean, is there a bigger message here to Latinos or to non-Latinos? Does it go both ways? Are you saying to Latinos, hey, brothers, sisters, you know, look what's on your back? Or are you saying to everybody, look what's on your back?
Well, the craziest thing about being from the Caribbean, especially if it's a Domingo, is that you feel that you're like the egg out of which the Americas cracked out. You know, the American eagle.
Here's the foot of Columbus.
Yeah.
Well, and then
the American eagle sprang from the Dominican Haitian egg. And so my concept is that it's more of a story about the Americas. So it's more about anyone who feels at all connected to what they call the great American century. In some ways, this is really related to you.
But is this family's journey, the family of Oscar Wilde, from Santo Domingo to Paterson, New Jersey, that ties it all together, that makes it really in one life, the life of one family?
Yeah, well, no, because, you know, every family is incredibly particular. I mean, it's so hard to talk about America, for example, if you just look at one single family. Any family makes the idea of a collective look absurd because we're so particular. But I just thought, like, you would start with this real big intergalactic kind of universal thing, and then you would focus down in the most ridiculous way on this poor overweight nerd.
And it's wonderful. 800-423-8255 is our number. Steve is calling from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air with Juno Diaz.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good. Mr. Diaz, I read your collection of short stories, Drown, and ever since I read it, I've been waiting for you to write a novel. It is a book that I've read maybe 8 or 9 times over the years, and it's really just incredible. And I'm so glad that, you know, you have finally finished a novel, and I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Steve, what about Drown? Why did it have you waiting with such anticipation? What was it exactly about that collection?
Well, Mr. Diaz writes so specifically and so beautifully about emotion and about situations that you're absolutely transported by the way that he uses language. And he has that gift of the bilingual to be able to use the best parts of both languages in order to communicate an idea. I found myself feeling like I was literate in another language after reading his book.
Bring on the Spanglish and the edges of Spanish, and there you are.
But also the thing that I wanted to say in support is that, you know, he's not... I know that the stories in Drown were about a specific group of people, but I don't think he's a writer for one group of people. I think that's tremendously unfair, and mm-hmm. I think it always happens to writers who are non-Western or non-white. They're always accused of speaking for a particular population. His gift is that he speaks so eloquently and so specifically that it can be understood across populations. So I just want Mr. Diaz to talk a little bit about being, you know, a writer and not just a writer of a particular ethnic background. Thanks so much.
Amen for that, Steve. Juno?
Well, that was such a... I feel like I paid this person. Thank you, Steve. And Hyde Park, man. That's like a cool place over there. No, I just... One of the things about writing in a language is that you're linked to that linguistic tradition. That's that. When the first caller called up, I mean, I'm as much Faulkner as I am Pedro Mir. It ends up happening. I mean, especially when you're a nerd like me who reads so much, you can't avoid, when you work in a language, being a child of that language. But as your caller pointed out, just because you work on one language specifically, you can't avoid being a part of a larger collective, which in our case is a human one.
And we're all right there, whether it's Faulkner writing from the South or you writing from this span of Santo Domingo to New Jersey, and it's wonderful to hear. I'd like to get the sound of a little more of it in our ear. There's a passage where you're introducing Oscar Wilde to us. And Oscar Wilde, what a name. Where does that come from?
It's just a mishearing of Oscar Wilde.
Right.
Yes. The poor kid shows up one day, college, dressed up for Halloween like Doctor Who, and his roommate is like, man, you look like that fat, what's his name, Oscar Wilde. And this other kid, this Dominican kid, goes, Oscar Wilde, who the hell is that?
And Oscar Wilde was right there, kind of born. Introduce him a little bit to us.
Yeah, no, I almost feel so bad that I inflicted him with this. But here's Oscar. He's just a mess, you know, the poor guy.
Yeah.
And so here's the description. Oscar was a social introvert who trembled with fear during gym class and who watched nerd British shows like Doctor Who and Blake 7. Could tell you the difference between a Veritech fighter and a Zentradi walker, and he used a lot of huge-sounding nerd words like indefatigable and ubiquitous when talking to folks who would barely graduate from high school. One of those nerds who was always hiding out the library and who, as the 80s marched on, developed a growing obsession with the end of the world. No apocalyptic movie or book or game existed that he had not seen or read or played. Wyndham and Christopher and Gamma World were his absolute favorites. You get the picture. His adolescent nerdliness vaporizing any iota of a chance he had for young love. Everybody else going through the terror and joy of their first crushes, their first date, their first kisses, while Oscar sat in the back of class, behind his Dungeon Master screen, and watched his adolescence stream by. Sucks to be left out of adolescence. Sort of like getting locked in that closet on Venus when the sun appears for the first time in 100 years. It would be one thing if, like some of the nerd boys I'd grown up with, Oscar hadn't cared about girls. But alas, he was still the passionate enamorado who fell in love easily and deeply. He had secret loves all over town, the kind of curly, big-bodied girls who wouldn't have said boo to a loser like him, but about whom he could not stop dreaming.
Junior Diaz reading from The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar. Wow. Science fiction is sort of the stew that he's in. He compares everything to it. He interprets family history and world history through science fiction. I mean, you hear it right there. Everything, and fantasy, everything from Dungeons and to Tolkien. Why?
Well, I mean, Boston's a perfect example of this. I moved into Boston, Cambridge area, 4 years ago. I've got really great friends here. And one of the great things about moving to any new place is that people have a second language. In Boston, all my boys compare everything and see everything through the Red Sox and the Patriots.
I had
to learn a whole new language, and I came up here to understand them.
Right.
Because that's the way that helps to get through life. That's the way they communicate.
Sure.
And they bond.
Mm.
Oscar, the way that he interprets life, his Patriots and his Red Sox is probably the nerdiest stuff that you could ever want, which is science fiction, fantasy. That's like his Jones, his bag. And it's kind of horrible because the thing that he's most passionate about actually is the thing that prevents him most clearly from getting any girls in this period.
The thing that he most wants.
Yeah.
So there's Oscar with his nerdiness, his sci-fi, his fantasy, his Tolkien, and but take us on through him, and there's Lola, his hot sister, and Junior, who returns here, maybe from your short stories, Drown, we'll talk about that, but take us to his mother. There we get closer to the kind of heart of darkness that lies behind this story. Introduce us to the mom and some of her history back in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, no, we meet her children, and her children are going through the kind of crazy adolescent stuff that happens, you know, and also, you know, they're trying to figure out and explain their way in the world, like in the United States, mm-hmm. like any adolescent. And their mom is always in the background, and she's kind of a pain in the butt. She's kind of like mean. Mm-hmm. And then we discover as we get into the book that the mother had in the Dominican Republic been a beautiful orphan growing up under her very strict, very religious, and very upstanding aunt.
Her father having been crushed by
Trujillo, by the dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But she knows very little about this history, and she really doesn't care. Mm-hmm. She's 14 when we meet her for real in the book. She's extraordinarily beautiful, which is dangerous at a young age in the Dominican Republic with a dictator who basically was a serial rapist.
Talk about rape rooms in Saddam. Trujillo is sort of the car paved the way.
Yeah, well, no, the country was a rape room. The entire Dominican Republic was his rape room. And, you know, when you hear about athletes having, like, an assistant who sits around on the sidelines and, you know, writes down the names of girls or the numbers of girls to give to the athletes afterward. Well, this guy had an entire secret police who tracked down any good-looking girl so he could rape them. And she's 14. This is the world she's living in, Dominican Republic, early 60s. And she falls in love with a member of the regime, someone she calls the gangster, mm-hmm. an older man. And that just leads to her fall. Because 14-year-old girl looking to escape, trading on her beauty, falls in with basically, you know, Chemical Ali of the Dominican mm-hmm. Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And good things are not going to go on from there.
she ends up so brutally beaten in a cane field in the Dominican Republic. I mean, it's hard to read. You really take us in to the horror of her end there. She finally makes it to the States. How does all this translate through to her kids?
I mean, that's in some ways what the novels leaves up to your imagination. You know, the fact that she, in her mind, the way that loved work and the way that loved foiled was thwarted for her, you know, the pain that she carries on her body and the sort of, you know, severity with which she raised her children. The idea is not that the narrator or me, the writer, draws a direct line, but sort of says, well, here you go. Now you try to fit all the pieces and tell me what you think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm much more interested in the reader putting the pieces together, because this is, in some ways, like all novels, it's a mystery.
Let's hear from one of those readers. Leora is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Leora, you're on the air with Chino Diaz.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm Chino Diaz. I just wanted to let you know that, just congratulations, because I saw you profiled in Latina magazine and then the New York Times, and I had read Drown a while ago and was just excited to see you all over the place and thinking, hooray, he's getting the recognition he needs and deserves. So
hooray.
Thank you.
but my question is, especially when it gets into the images of the mother with the scar on her back and in that way carrying the history, the first thing that came to mind for me was thinking about Toni Morrison's Beloved, and where the main character of the book kind of carries a similar history with a scar on her back. So it made me think of, I just wanted to ask you if you can talk a little bit about, you know, there's usually the traditional image of women carrying a people's history and a country's history, and you certainly have that in the book, but then there's also Oscar. So if you can talk a little bit more about kind of either the similarities or differences between how men, Dominican men, Latino men, or just men in general carry history, perhaps the same or differently than women.
Oh, there's a lot, Leora. Thanks. Gino?
No, that's an awesome question. First of all, just the same way, I mean, especially Beloved, one of my favorite books. Toni Morrison's Beloved, you know, Nobel Prize winner. The book itself won the Pulitzer. Your caller was completely right. I jack that image of Sethi's back for Belicia. Just something that I wanted the two books to sort of speak to each other. It was kind of like an homage. And in Beloved, you have the women having to face the history of both the family, but also the legacy of slavery. The two sons, Bugler and Howard, run off, if I remember their names right, and they disappear before any of the problems start. With me, I was like, you know what? Let me see what would happen if the sons, if we'd actually followed these sons. Just running from the house doesn't mean that you can escape Beloved.
Gino Diaz, born and raised until six or so in the Dominican Republic, and then up to New Jersey, like the character in his new book, The Characters. Oscar Wao, early on, you know, in the story, goes back to the Dominican Republic himself with his family. We should read a bit of that for us.
Yeah, here comes Oscar, has been back in Santo Domingo for years, and his impressions after he gets off the plane. The beat you down heat was the same, and so was the feckin' tropical smell that he had never forgotten, that to him was more evocative than any Madeline. And likewise the air pollution and the thousands of motors and cars and dilapidated trucks on the roads and the clusters of peddlers at every traffic light. So dark, he noticed, and his mother said dismissively, "Maldito Haitianos," and people walking languidly with nothing to shade them from the sun, and the buses that charged past so overflowing passengers that from the outside they looked like they were making a rush delivery of spare limbs to some far-off war, and the general ruination of so many of the buildings, as if Santo Domingo was the place that crumbled, crippled concrete shells came to die. And the hunger on some of the kids' faces, can't forget that. But it also seemed in many places like a whole new country was materializing atop the ruins of the old one. There were now better roads and nicer vehicles and brand new luxury air-conditioned buses plying the longer routes to the Cibao and beyond, and U.S. fast food restaurants, Dunkin' Donuts and Burger King, and the local ones whose names and logos he did not recognize, Pollos Victorina and El Provocón Número Cuatro, and traffic lights everywhere that nobody seemed to heed.
Juno Diaz reading from Oscar Wilde. Juno, I want to keep bringing your readers in to talk with us here, if I may. Liz is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, Liz. Thanks. Hi, Juno. I read Drown a long time ago as well and thought it was wonderful. I'm actually part Dominican, and I was born and raised in New York City, and your descriptions of Dominican nuances and idiosyncrasies are just wonderful and usually have me laughing hysterically. One thing that I think a lot about and I guess troubles me is sort of the racism and internal racism and the hatred or the thing with Haitians that permeates so much of the culture and or maybe just my family, I don't know. But you don't write about that a lot, and I was wondering your thoughts on that and if it's something you think about too.
Liz, do you mean racism where exactly? There, here, both?
Both. I mean, Dominicans are, many of them are black, and mm-hmm. yet you would think not from the way the culture, embedded in the culture, is sort of a disparaging remarks about black people and a lot of hatred about Haitians that I hear from my family and from other Dominican folks as well.
Juno, speak to it.
Yeah, no, I think it's really... You know, it's sort of something that's important and too much silence around. I mean, the one thing about it is I always feel like I am writing about it, you know. I have a lot of friends who keep telling me, they're like, will you stop writing about how much we make fun and dislike Haitians and dislike dark-skinned people? And, you know, there's other people who never think, you know, who think that, oh, we need to do something more directly. I think the Caribbean, I think the concept that anti-black racism is something that is only found in certain sectors of the white population is absurd. The thing is, one thing that joins all the Americas together is that anywhere you go, dark people aren't considered beautiful or popular. In Santo Domingo, the dark bugbear is Haitians. And you'll have Dominicans who are the darkest Dominicans you'll ever see in the world talking about how black people are criminals and thieves, and you should be careful about dating them. And, you know, you're always left with, wow, human nature, the contradictions are really strong. The only thing that I would always caution people with it is that one has to remember that the Dominican Republic was the only place that endured and inflicted an anti-black genocide.
Under Trujillo, against Haitians and Haitian Dominicans. And so, what exactly happened there?
1937, October... the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti was a very interesting, very productive place. My grandfather can speak Creole. He's Dominican. It was a third country. And, you know,
the kind of overlap the along that long border right down to the middle of what had been Hispaniola.
And deep into the center of the country. Mm-hmm. And you know how it is. Dictators don't like things that are like hybrid. They love stuff nice and neat.
Mm-hmm. And nothing funky here, please.
Yeah, and it's hard to control a population that has multiple languages and multiple identities. Mm-hmm. And so he needed to seal the country off, and plus a number of things. I mean, it takes a lot to talk about it, but he committed a genocide where he basically carved that border neat, distinct, clear, and bloodily on the bodies of the Haitian community and Haitian Dominicans. And that trauma continues on mm-hmm. to today. So a lot of Dominicans were walking around saying like, ah, you know, they're super dark, saying, I don't like dark Dominicans. Mm. And the shadow probably that's hanging over the head is a machete that's saying, if you're sitting around talking about how you're dark, you might end up getting chopped in half.
Mm-hmm. There's the history echoing, whether they're listening or not.
Or aware of it or not. Mm-hmm. And so, but I do think it's very, very pernicious. It's found all over the islands. I mean, God, I grew up in an African-American community in the United States, and, you know, it might not seem as explicit, but it was so present there. I mean, my black neighbors would always tell me, they're like, you're so light-skinned, make sure you don't date no dark-skinned girls.
So the sensitivity to gradations of skin color.
Sure, and it's just weird. One thing about American culture, whether I said the top of Alaska to the bottom of Tierra del Fuego, that joins us all together is a general suspicion and disparagement of dark skin.
But in this country today, and I mean, you know, you can call these exceptions or whatever you like, but... You know, we do have those people from Oprah to Condoleezza Rice to Barack Obama to all kinds of entertainment and sports stars and business leaders. I mean, is that happening in the Dominican Republic as well?
Of course. Of course. I think that that's what... Look, no system is like comic books. Mm-hmm. No system is 100%. It's not like in Lord of the Rings where mm-hmm. all the orcs are bad and all the elves are good. It doesn't work that way. If you look at an individual case, there are no patterns. If you look at a pattern, there are no individual cases. And the thing is to have a subtle enough mind and have an open enough mind. I mean, I don't want to say subtle. That sounds so ridiculous. But just to have an open enough mind to be aware that it's possible for there to be individuals and possible for there to be patterns, and neither need to eliminate the other for us to have a discussion.
Liz, thanks very much for that call. Gino Diaz, one of the callers mentioned it earlier, and it's something that comes through so clearly in this book and in your earlier short stories as well. I mean, you're really looking for... Let's not walk away from the word subtle for a second. You're really looking for those subtle, unspoken things in life as a writer that you latch on to, articulate, bring up, and lay in front of us. It's as though the world takes on more dimensionality in your hands because you won't let any of those little resonances go. Is that a conscious approach on your part? Let's look at the edges. Let's look at what's not spoken.
Well, yeah. I mean, look. Again, being an artist is so darn demanding because the bar that reality sets is so incredibly high. I mean, how you can't marshal enough words and enough talent to match reality's ability to wow someone at the level of narrative, the level of story, just at the level of just the way that reality can build a building. It's hard to defeat that. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find different ways to get to that essence of what life, of what being human feels like. And so you have to deploy a lot of tricks. For me, I end up working at the most microscopic level. No matter how loud and raucous my narrator seems to be, it's what is not being said where most of the emotional work is being done. In this book, we never hear Junior really talk about how his love affair with Lola went bad.
Junior, we haven't even mentioned, but the one-time lover of Lola, sister of Oscar. Same Junior as in your short stories a decade ago?
It's supposed to be.
And his character is?
Oh, he's just the opposite of Oscar. I mean, the setup of the book is the person telling the story is the womanizing,
the swashbuckling
Dominican macho,
you know,
who is like basically frightened of himself and of the world to his core. Which is why he has this incredible tough exterior and is a nonstop liar in the world. And his life with this family and his life specifically with this complete opposite, this complete loser, Oscar, and just how they interact and how they pull on each other.
It's interesting that Junior came back here after having lived so vividly in Drown. Was that intentional on your part? I mean, is Junior a fixture? You can be like John Updike and keep the same character coming back book after book.
Damn, man! I hope I can write him
like
John Updike, man. Man, give me some rabbit up in
Pump
here.
Pump it out, yeah.
Nah, just even the talent on it. So, no, it's just that I always think it's good that as an artist is to always undermine whatever work that you had before. The thought that there is a master story or a master narrative or that there's one version of who we are has never been attracted to me. Mm-hmm. So that I have a book which is really defines Junior as one way, which is Drown. And in this book, I just looked back and was like, you know what? Let me try to demolish.
Just turn it around.
And also just confuse it. I mean, I would rather have people arguing about who a person really is because that's like we're having a conversation than have we've already decided who they are.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Joe in Brockton, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Gino, I wanted to ask you about Drown. In fact, I wanted to get your opinion on the notion that Foucault could also have a personal aspect, like the curse of the successful first book. And I wondered if you would talk about the experience of the publication of Drown, and did that experience contribute to the time it took you to complete the second book?
Yeah, no, thank you so much. It's a good question. Honestly, I think that if I hadn't published Drown, I probably would have finished the second book in a year and a half simply because there would have been no noise. It just would have been quiet. And desperation has a way of lighting a fire under you.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Sooner or later.
Yeah. Well, though, especially a desperation, had I continued to work making photocopies for a living, I would have been so desperate.
Oh, the quiet desperation before any publication.
Yeah, yeah. So if Drown hadn't been published, I probably would have banged the second one out.
Right.
And I think it's like that movie adaptation, mm-hmm. you know, where the guy's having problems writing his film
right,
script.
Right.
And so he builds in the problem he's having writing his film script right. into the film script. It was the same way. I mean, of course, I felt so blessed to be able to publish a book, to be able to have the time and the support to write a book. Yeah. And to be able to come at the right moment in my life that it came off even slightly well. So you're incredibly blessed, and then suddenly no words come. And there's a part of you that begins to think like, hey, are you being set up? Is this some crazy, like, Greek tragedy?
Fuku.
Yeah, man. Is this some crazy curse? And so then you're like, man, you know, let me try to work this in somehow. Because right. if I don't embrace it, it's probably going to bite me on the ass right, for a couple yeah. more years.
You better own it.
Yeah, exactly.
And eventually you did, and we're happy for that. Joe, thanks. Carly's calling from Lake Placid, New York. Carly, you're on the air with Juno Diaz.
Oh, hi. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. I haven't gotten a chance to read either of your books, but I look forward to you since I've heard from you on the show. And I was just curious, though, about your characters, anything about them are autobiographical, because you mentioned that you read a lot and that you're a little bit nerdy, maybe.
Thank you so much. Yeah, no, there's no question how... I always think that the two male characters in this book, Oscar and Junior, one of them is like a weightlifting, womanizing lunatic, you know, who basically sleeps his way through Rutgers College. And the other one is this incredibly nerdy guy who can tell you everything about Andre Norton science fiction books and Japanese mangas.
And you, Mr. Diaz?
The problem with me is that I feel both of those people. My father was one of those military guys who had me boxing, who had me at the rifle range every Sunday. Mm. Who, if anybody spoke to me, would have me smacking them out, because otherwise he would smack me the hell out. Mm. And then when I was hiding from that kind of rough world that I was growing up, and I was a serious weightlifter in college, you know, you do the steroids, you do whatever you do to try to build it all up. And, you know, when I was hiding from that, I was this incredible nerd who read comic books, read science fiction, and couldn't believe how he ended up behind all these muscles and fighting with people at bars. It was just, I couldn't make sense of it.
Yeah, a little bit of both going on there, Carly. It sounds like, you know, one of our callers earlier, you know, talked about what has been a pattern, a problem, where writers like yourself get characterized as this or that, the Latino writer, the Dominican-American writer. But here we are, it's 2007. There's obviously an openness to the sort of range of language and perspective you're putting on the table. Do you feel in this culture, at this time, do you still feel boxed up, or do you feel free to kind of lay it out there in the confidence that there's a multicultural readership now that will just pick it up as literature?
I feel like there's three answers. Well, there's a number of answers to that. I mean, I think we're humans, man. We can't help it. We love to categorize. We even do it to people we really love and the people we want to think large.
You're the funny one. You're the pretty one. You're the whatever.
We just like it. It's just mm-hmm. simple. The world is so complicated. Mm-hmm. I sometimes think if we didn't have our little boxes, we would go crazy. It's very damaging, of course, and we pay for that. Mm. But it's just who we are. I think that we are in a culture that simultaneously wants to imagine that there are no boxes, but has made the boxes all the harder to get out of. But my thing is, even with Drown, I'm a reader. And the one thing that you learn as a reader is to have faith in other readers. I've always believed that people who read a book, who mm-hmm. trust you mm-hmm. enough to sit for a couple hundred pages, are not looking to box you or box themselves, but they're looking to just meet another human being. And that... it sounds completely like Oprah Winfrey, New Age stuff, but I really believe it. I think you can't be a reader if in your heart you're looking for boxes. You read because in your heart you're really looking for doors.
Get out of that box. Open that door. It's a great trip out right here. I enjoyed it enormously, and congratulations on bringing it to us at last, Juno Diaz.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to all the callers for taking the time.
Listen, Juno Diaz is going to be reading in a lot of cities where we air in the coming weeks: New York, Houston, Ann Arbor, Austin, St. Louis, Iowa City, Madison, Wisconsin, and many others. There's a list of his upcoming reading tour at our website, onpointradio.org. Science fiction next, I hear. You got something cooking?
I'm hoping. We'll
okay.
see.
Okay. We won't speak of it too soon. We don't want to fuku here. It's been great having you. The new book is The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Juno Diaz, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you all.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Chris Burrell, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonas, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.